Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and never miss an episode. Rate and review us while you're there. My guests today are Reason Magazine Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Ward and Reason.com's Robbie Suave. Today we're going to talk about the Trump inauguration, the Women's March on D.C. I guess we'll have to talk about crowd size because that seems like size matters. But we're also going to be talking about education reform. Today is the kickoff day for National School Choice Week, which is an annual event promoting the ability of parents and students to have greater options in K through 12 education. It's national, nationwide. Over 21,000 events will be taking place over the next week. And you can go to schoolchoice.org to get more information about events and activities and data and whatnot that's in your area. So Reason is a media sponsor of National School Choice Week, and regular readers of the magazine and of the website and viewers of our videos know that we take a strong interest in education reform and especially increasing school choice to all Americans. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Robbie, thank you for coming out today.
Thanks for having me.
So we had the Trump inaugural address, as well as the spectacle of his marching around, sometimes to empty bandstands, other times it was actually quite well watched on television. It had the second highest TV ratings since Obama's. It had the highest ratings except for Obama's 2009 inaugural in a few years ago, going back to about 1969. Catherine, everybody, including Reason, said, you know, this was a dark inaugural. There was something kind of off about it. Do you agree with that, or what was the vibe that you pulled out of it, and what significance should we attach to it?
Certainly the speech was surprisingly dark, though I'm not sure it was intentionally dark. I mean, this was not, to my mind, something where Trump woke up and said, I need to drive home the dire situation that America is in to spur people to action. I think he gave his stump speech, which is itself dark, with the direct campaign attacks edited out. I mean, Trump's narrative is not a happy one. It's, you know, he's going to make America great again, but it's not great now. And he just said that again at a sort of from a fancier table. But I don't think it was meant to be dark, but it's telling that everyone read it as so dark.
Well, you know, and here's a question. I just follow up with that. Did people read it as dark? Certainly the media did. Everybody, you know, and Chris Matthews took the prize when he referred to it as Hitlerian. Because of the focus on the nation. And then he was like, well, it's not about race, but it's about nation. It's Hitlerian in that way. You know, it seems to me like the complaints that he was making or the complaints he was addressing, which did get him into office, are not that substantially different than what Bernie Sanders was saying. And to a certain degree, Hillary Clinton. And this, I guess, for me, is odd. Like Trump is both ridiculously optimistic. He's, you know, he's great. We're going to win. We're going to get tired of winning. We're the greatest country in the world, but we need to be made great again. But that isn't all that different than, you know, when he's talking about people losing jobs. That's what Sanders was running on, right? To haven't the banktards taken all the good jobs? All the factory jobs are gone. Aren't we overrun by people who are taking away all of our rights? So, you know, do you think, Catherine, that, you know, while all of us, I think, in the media and people who didn't vote for him think it's dark, but everybody's vision of America is kind of pretty dark right now?
But inaugurals are one place where we tend to indulge in a little bit of a gauzier vision of America. That's why it was striking. I mean, I actually spent some time doing word search comparisons across past inaugural addresses after listening to Trump, because I was trying to gauge my own bias on this, right? When I listened to him, I heard, oh my God, it's blood and soil. It's, you know, it's, but I actually looked up a bunch of the keywords. And while it's true that no other president has used the word carnage in his inaugural address, it was striking as I was reading through these past inaugurals, particularly 20th century inaugural speeches, how actually Trump's was pretty normal. There was a lot of, you know, we are patriots, but we need to reinvigorate our patriotism. We need to band together in these difficult times. The bashing of his predecessors while they were sitting right there seems pretty unusual. And the sort of campaigniness of that is where the darkness came from. But in terms of the call on unity and the appeal to Americanness, that's actually pretty standard. And in particular, I found a lot of the same stuff in Obama's speeches, but Obama's was a lot prettier, frankly, which made it more palatable.
And I would add to that, and this is something, you know, Reason picked up on and a lot of other people picked up on. Ben Domenech wrote about it in The New York Times, the Federalist Ben Domenech, is the Dark Knight Rises sort of connection in the speech, which is the villain of that film, Bane. It's almost like Trump lifted parts of the speech from Bane, who has this very faux populist message that he's, you know, giving Gotham back to the people, that the people are now going to be in charge, when really he, you know, he doesn't care about the people at all. He has this, you know, super villain sort of agenda, and that it was there was some similar undertones there. If not in tone, in I mean, the darkness is what Trump wants to do, right? I mean, in some sense, who cares, you know, how optimistic he sounds, or, you know, he's a different kind of political character, but he wants to enact these sort of striking economic intervention. He wants to interfere in like every small ball business decision that's going to be made to stop jobs from moving overseas, even if that would be more efficient, even if that's conducive to economic growth. He said, as a rule, we will buy American and hire American as a rule. And that's, you know, that's kind of dark for the leader of the free world to say.
Yeah, but
it's pivot away from free.
I would say, though, that's also, if we're going to have a supervillain, you know, if we're picking a supervillain for Trump to be, fine, he can be Bane. I'm kind of grateful at least he didn't go full Loki, right? Like, he could have said, you know, humanity is made to kneel. Like, you crave subjugation. He likes Putin. He likes Putin's Loki. Like, maybe Bane's not so bad.
Well, but it's almost worse that his authoritarianism, I think, is slightly hidden in this veneer of I'm just doing what the people, you know, in a sort of quintessential dictatorial way.
Here's a question for you, though, because I think, you know, and I dislike Trump immensely, but I also think that one of the reasons he's so confounding to people is because his message, he's certainly not a Reagan Republican in terms of, you know, first and foremost, just the attitude and the demeanor. Reagan was famously sunny. Trump is always looking around the room. You know, he's got his resting bitch face on all the time, where his lips are kind of pursed out, and he always looks like he's going to slug somebody. And he sees the world as zero sum. So it's, if anybody else is doing well, it means by definition he is doing less well. Having said that, you know, he is participating in the left, not a left, but a liberal populist talk. I saw over the weekend somebody from The Nation magazine talking about, like, oh, well, you know what, he's actually right about trade. You know, we need to bring jobs back, and we need to be going after the banks, and we need to be, you know, criticizing Wall Street. I mean, and I saw Michael Moore on CNN saying, you know what, I actually agree with a lot of Trump's agenda, because it's a populist left-wing agenda in many ways. And then on the right, I mean, people like George Will and Bill Kristol were saying, oh, this is vulgar and terrible, because he's refusing to say that America is the leader of the free world. The concept of the free world is totally embedded in the Cold War. And what happens when, you know, Europe isn't subjugated anymore, and maybe the idea of the free world, where most countries are free and there is not an existential threat like the Soviet Union to the free West, maybe it is time that we stop using language that doesn't really describe much anymore. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, but it's like that people are aghast that he's not playing by a script that was written in post-war, you know, post-World War II, Cold War. And, you know, my question is kind of like, why should he be?
Well, people are aghast for the wrong reasons. I think you can make that argument, right? I mean, the people who are aghast at Trump because his economic policies would be ruinous to, you know, to prosperity and would violate individual rights, that's not all that many people, probably. That's mostly libertarians. That's the
it's pretty much just us here on this podcast.
Yeah.
Well, but more Democrats believe, according to Pew and Gallup, more Democrats now agree that free trade agreements such as NAFTA and TPP are good for the country than do Republicans. Republicans traditionally are in favor of free trade, but they hate immigrants. Democrats, at least recently, you know, they're against free trade because they want to protect industries and jobs here. But then they, you know, but then they're a pro-immigrant. And I think he's jumbling things in a way that is genuinely not allowing, you know, the two major groups that control discourse, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, to feel comfortable because their plans, they don't work anymore. They don't make a lot of sense, and they're self-contradictory, and they draw fewer and fewer people.
Well, and the opposition is contradictory because I saw this at the Women's March. I saw, you know, socialists are marching. You have people with signs that are about how the economic system of, you know, of free markets and free trade has failed us. But Trump broadly agrees with that. So it makes no sense that you're marching against someone who on economic policy, you know, broadly shares that view. They don't like him because he's coarse. And he said, you know, he said truly despicable things, you know, about women and immigrants and other groups. But that's the source of their opposition to Trump. It's not even on his economic policies, clearly.
And actually, the Women's March did. I think the Women's March revealed how difficult it's going to be to oppose Trump, at least in the short run, precisely because he's non-ideological, because we don't exactly know which direction he's going to go on an awful lot. A lot of issues. It's what Robbie pointed out, you know, and this is true. I mean, we should say this is true of all large marches. They attract anybody who has a cause, right? I mean, remember when the Free Mumia used to show up at every single march, regardless of meaning? You know, we saw some of that for sure at the Women's March, but it had a little bit of a feel to me of the straw man march. I mean, of course, it makes sense broadly for women to say, we collectively don't feel great about this guy who said horrible things about women specifically, but the assortment of signage was frequently a sort of stuff no one could disagree with, you know, women's rights or human rights. And, you know, I understand those are code words and that they're sort of alluding to specific issues, but, you know, Trump is actually, as far as Republicans go, not, I would say, terribly likely to make a big issue out of reproductive rights and abortion. Of course, he'll have Supreme Court nominees that could go any direction. So the sort of idea that, you know, people are trying to unite in opposition to him and they don't even know what to unite against is certainly something I've felt. And I think that's going to be a problem going forward. There's not an ideological roadmap here and the Cold War is not helping.
Yeah,
he is arguably the most socially progressive, probably inarguably the most socially progressive Republican ever elected to the White House. And he's arguably more socially progressive than President Obama was when he took office at the beginning. Obviously, President Obama evolved from there and did a lot of things to advance, various.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, certainly, you know, he articulated during the campaign, you know, that he's against abortion. Which I think is oftentimes the single most kind of, the highest target on all of this type of stuff. And he went so far, as you'll recall, to say, because he had clearly not thought it through and followed the logic of the position. A lot of people on the right got pissed at him when he said, you know, yeah, abortion should be against the law and that women should be punished as well as any doctors who perform them. And there's a whole kind of situation or position on the right, which is ridiculous, that women should never be held accountable for having abortions unless their doctors performing them, because the woman is the second victim of the abortion. And Trump obviously hadn't gotten that memo because he doesn't travel in those circles. There's footage of him from 20 years ago talking about how he, you know, basically believes that abortion on demand should last right up until the moment of birth. But it's unclear as to whether or not he will be directing anything that has anything to do with possibly rolling back Roe versus Wade on things like paid family leave, on things like, subsidized child care, or creating more government either funded or subsidized daycare. He seems to be very much into that. And he doesn't seem to really give a shit about gay marriage in a way that I think Republicans generally still do. On pot, it remains to be seen, you know, and then so I agree with you, Robbie, in that sense. But it's do you think Robbie, you were at the Women's March?
Yep.
Yeah. What was the vibe? Were people there? Were they most was it actually directed towards Trump, you know, or was it more that this was also a moment where, you know, women who had, you know, and it wasn't all women, obviously, but people who had voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton were also given a chance to kind of vent their frustration that she had won the popular vote and still lost?
Yeah, in some sense, there's a feeling that this march was, you know, an answer to a feeling that women had, that they had been sort of their rights and their common humanity was, you know, uniquely violated in this election cycle because what would have been the first female presidential, the first female president was rejected. And in her place, the guy won has this kind of, you know, over the top negative statements about women and kind of dismissing their importance and saying really nasty things about them. I mean, you have to give the march some credit, I think, in that it had just an unbelievable number of people. You know, I was trying to kind of move through it, see the signs, talk to people. And I had to turn back. I was afraid I was going to get, you know, trapped the further I walked in because there were so many people. And, you know, it was pretty orderly. It was, you know, had some issues that they didn't let everyone participate. They didn't want pro-life women to participate. They kind of failed the sort of intersectionality caused them to fail the broad inclusivity test. You know, how those things ends up shaking out is always entertaining. But I think you have to give it, you know, credit for staying broadly on focus that we are upset. Womankind is upset that Trump has this record of
and I so think he's fair, got the. Here's the question. You know, so he's got the pussy grabbing comments, which I think, you know, that really kind of lit a lot of people up, I think, for understandable reasons. And then there were the vague and unsubstantiated instances of other kinds of sexual harassment and whatnot, which I don't think really rose to that level. Catherine, how much of it is it, do you think also that Trump? And this goes back to you had kind of mentioned Putin before, but that Trump is I wouldn't say he's a male chauvinist pig because he hires a lot of women. He surrounds himself with women in business situations and in kind of TV situations, which he doesn't have to do. But he really comes across as an unreconstructed kind of male chauvinist pig from, you know, circa 1980 or something.
Right. I mean, one thing that's interesting to me is I think virtually all of Trump's behavior, with the exception of the pussy grabbing comment, which, you know, was, I guess, technically a hot mic, so it's not clear that it was intended for public consumption, is probably basically normal behavior 40 years ago in America. You know, pretty much every president probably said that kind of garbage about women up until the very, very, very recent modern era. You know, I'm not a huge fan of Obama, but Obama probably doesn't think or say those things about women. And I think we might have gotten a little bit used to that. You know, this idea of the kind of post-boomer, post-greatest generation president, and then to be thrown back into it with, as you say, this person who's kind of an avatar of what we thought we had left behind. I do think that motivated the Women's March and opposition to him generally, that it feels like moving backward.
And I've been a critic of some of these over the top, you know, kind of this person's a sexist for this reason. You know, you see this a lot on college campuses. I write about this a lot, where we're just casting such a broad net for labeling people sexist and labeling certain things sexual harassment and harassment. But that said, and given that I've made those critiques, I do think, you know, that just basically the pussy grabbing comment. I mean, that was over a line that you would, you know, that is outside the normal bounds, I think, you know, as Catherine.
His general tendency, which is well documented, to say, oh, you know, she's a 10, she's a 3, she's a 5. We shouldn't. I mean, he says over and over, we shouldn't listen to the words this woman is saying about a topic of importance to her because she is physically unattractive. And that's an idea that was, I think, pretty, I mean, this was before my time, but I think was a commonly voiced thing that was sort of a normal thing to say not that long ago, but we've gotten used to a world where it is not a normal thing to say anymore. So used to it, in fact, that we now are hypersensitive to even the slightest echo of that type of talk, which keeps Robbie Suave in business on Reasons 4.
Yeah, well, and his response to Carly Fiorina, and you know, early on, because a lot of the you know, she's a 3 or a 10 or whatever, or you know, there's a famous quote of like, it doesn't matter what they write about you as long as you have like a young piece of ass on your arm. A lot of those go back to the 90s even, but the Carly Fiorina comment where he was like, you know, look at that face, during the primary season was, you know, was a pretty strong indication of that, and it provided her with her best kind of debate performance when she came back and she said, we all know what he means by that. And it is true, like we've moved on broadly as a society from kind of putting up with that, or at least having that in wide circulation. In the same way, I was looking at over the weekend, I was reading a Life magazine story about Huddy Leadbetter, the Leadbelly, the blues man. And in the 40s, I think it was, Life magazine had a story called, you know, Bad Nigger Makes Good Music. And it was about Leadbelly had been put in jail several times for violent crime. And it was like, holy cow, this was like after World War II or something. And they're, you know, that's Life magazine was the biggest magazine in the world. Like that, you would never see that. And I think there's something similar to that kind of thing going on. Catherine, did you watch the Ashley Judd comments? Because it seemed to me, I posted something about it at Reason, and she gave a speech she recited a poem, which seemed to be pure old school feminism, where it wasn't so much talking about, okay, well, we need, we need subsidized health care, and we need this, and we need that. And it was more just about women need to be taken seriously. I'm curious if you saw that, and if that, if you respond to that. One of the things that is interesting is that a character like that who is a kind of semi-retired Hollywood actress who talks a lot and has talked about running for office in Tennessee, her adoptive home state. And a lot of people really hate her guts. But I thought that was refreshing at a woman's march, because it was like, you know, it was the type of speech you would expect at a march about women saying we really want social and economic and political equality.
Yeah, I watched the video of it, and I think, you know, I think there's partially it was just, you know, the crowd response to it seems to have been, we are crowded a women's march and we're going to cheer for anything. I guess I didn't necessarily see, though I wasn't there, quite how strongly people responded to it. But yeah, there really are kind of two threads happening, and they were happening at this women's march of, you know, women's rights are human rights, which is a sort of foundational feminist type thing to say.
But and you then, said it was also those were code words. What are those code words for?
Right. So
because and heaven forbid that we call them a dog whistle, right? Because this is a woman's march.
Right. Yeah, that's a good. Careful there, Donald. I mean, you know, I think it means different things to different people, which is why it's a great thing to put on a poster at a rally.
Right.
It can both mean it's surface text, and it can mean essentially, if you do not support abortion on demand, you are violating my human rights. Mm-hmm. And you can read both of those things in those words, but you know, the laundry list of demands that we saw at, for instance, Occupy, which, you know, had a sort of similar everything in the kitchen sink vibe to the Women's March. Again, as we were saying before, Trump is like pretty inclined to grant a bunch of those demands on the policy side. I mean, I've said before, and I really believe that I will not be at all surprised if one of his very early agenda items is some kind of universal preschool, some kind of child care tax credit, something in that vein, which would be the kind of thing you would see on a laundry list for a march like this. And then there's the other piece, which is like, could you stop being such a dick? And that's not really the sort of thing you put on a list of demands, but is in fact the actual demand of many of these marchers.
The marchers want Ryan Gosling delivering these policies, just not Donald Trump.
I fully support Ryan Gosling for president.
Here's a question, because and people make a lot of hay out of this type of stuff. And as somebody who covered the Tea Party marches and a bunch of other, Occupy things and rallies for labor and all of that. You know, Catherine, and I'm thinking back to, I might have been in college when Mumia was still a thing. But, you know, where you get that whole ragtag, you know, okay, we got to run through like 50 things, so we're going to say it really quickly. But Angela Davis showed up at the end, and Angela Davis is a 60s radical or 60s and 70s radical who was a Black Panther who fled the country on numerous charges related to violence and overthrowing the government. There are pictures of her floating around the internet where she was a state guest of Erich Honecker of East Germany for a while. And she would support, she went to Cuba for a while, but it wasn't even like Castro that she was in love with. It was Brezhnev and Erich Honecker. And it's, you know, these are like the unsexiest, communist leaders and stuff. And she got up and spoke, and she immediately switched. She didn't really talk that much about women's rights. She talked a bit about race. She's Black. And then she talked about Palestinian rights. And I guess my question is, where does intersectionality go to die? The idea that, nobody is simply one cultural identity or one type of oppressed person, and you've got to look at the intersection of all of these different things. It made me a little bit sad that the Women's March, constantly speaker after speaker, seemed to be giving way to say, like, we're not really talking about feminism, which is a framework by which you look at how gender impacts everything or influences things, to saying, okay, well, we're going to put gender issues aside so that we can talk about Palestinian rights. Like, will women ever boldly assert that, no, fuck it, this is actually just about being treated equally as a woman?
I mean, they never have, right? Like, There, since the very beginning of the women's movement, there have been debates about this thing, which we now call intersectionality, and, the relationship between abolitionists and suffragettes was utterly fraught.
The suffragettes at one point after the Civil War, actually, and when the amendments were being written to enfranchise Black men, they went and said, hey, you know, what about us? We were the early abolitionists. And now you're cutting us out. And there was a huge break between Frederick Douglass and abolitionists, some abolitionists who were in favor of just enfranchising Black men and their female supporters that actually lasted for decades. Maybe that's why they don't do it anymore, because you don't get very far.
Well, in this historical moment where in enfranchising Black men, that we introduce into America's founding documents the first gendered language, explicitly gendered language. Like, that's a sort of almost comically symbolical turn of events there. But people who have thought longer and harder about this than I, including probably Robbie Suave. So feel free to jump in and mansplain here if you like, Blondie. But
I'm waiting.
There's I think the piece of this where the kind of cracks show is in these little pre-March kerfuffles about, we're excluding pro-life women, but we're including Palestinian rights. I mean, that's a real moment where we're sort of showing our hand and saying, you know, maybe this isn't actually about who has, you know, X chromosomes or who identifies as woman or wherever you want to draw the line. It's actually just about kind of progressive causes. In the end, I don't think that's what the march was, but I think that's what the march organizers might have been leaning toward. But Robbie, take it away on intersectionality.
I mean, and when looking
Robbie,
at this stuff,
Robbie, tell us, tell us what women want. Catherine and I are dying to know. Her more than me,
Robbie.
Because I, you know, in the end, I can just, I can just assert it. So,
yeah. here I go. When looking at these things, particularly on college campuses, I've really come around to the view that intersectionality is just like cancer for sustainable political movements or issue-based coalitions, right? Because if you're trying to, if you're trying to move the ball on some issue, let's say it's like criminal justice reform. Okay, we want to cast a wide net. We want to, we actually want to get conservatives on board with it, people who are unlikely to support it. So we don't want to focus on how it's, we don't want to make it, no, you have to agree that, that this issue uniquely hurts people of color, and uniquely hurts women of color. And beyond that, it's really a trans rights issue. And you make it narrower and narrower and narrower until you have only like 20 people who could be in support of the thing you're trying to change. And when you see issues like, I think how gay marriage has come to be broadly accepted, and you had political change everywhere, so it's acceptable. Like, that wasn't about taking the narrowest group of people. That they were making arguments that, you know, gay people want to start families, they're just like you, and so on. It's making it as broad as possible. And that's the problem with this sort of intersectionality liberal movement on campuses, is that it seeks division, because it says you have to agree with all these things, and you actually have to identify as all these specific, very specific things, mm-hmm. In order to be worthy of joining the movement. And then you don't have a movement anymore.
Isn't it also a kind of real instantiation of the slippery slope? I mean, that's what it's always struck me, is not so much about the divisions. It's about saying, the minute that you grant, for instance, that, you know, gay people should be allowed to marry, you actually, a lot of the kind of discourse around intersectionality shoves you right yes. down the slope into like Rick Santorum's man dog marriage, right? I mean, not to put it to the most yes. controversial example, but you know, you can only say yes to reasonable incremental change X if you also say yes to, you know, multi-party, multi-gender, multi-generational marriages. The end.
Yes. Yeah, and yes to
Palestinian freedom and yes.
and blah, yeah.
Do you think that this represents on the part of a kind of intersectionalists on the left in particular? And these are generally not liberals. I think they're more ideologically way out there. But is it simply a rejection of kind of the Enlightenment value of universal equality, universal citizenship, so to speak? Because one of the things, I was talking with somebody over the weekend about some of this stuff, and they were saying, you know, it shouldn't be that hard to say the reason why I think that trans people, who, you know, are a thing now that we talk about a lot, despite relatively small numbers. And 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to the extent that transgendered people were discussed, it was in radically different terms. And not necessarily negative terms. It was just, it meant something different. But is it a rejection of that idea of saying that we should have, you know, equality before the law, and that the government should not be able to discriminate, because we are all equal before the law, just as in a religious period we might have been all equal before God? Is it a rejection of that makes it very difficult for libertarians who believe, I think, you know, fundamentally in that equality? It makes it hard for us to partner with people like that, in a different way with conservatives, who might say, yeah, I believe in equality before the law, but we have to take into account certain customs that refuse any sanction or even equality under the law for things like gay marriage, for things like, gender neutral bathrooms. I mean, are we like the last inheritors of that kind of full bore, you know, Enlightenment ideal that, you don't have the right to government shouldn't have the right to punish people unless they are, you know, really doing harm to other people?
Well, they're the new tribalists. We see it as individual rights always, right? That the smallest minority is the individual. I think that's something Ayn Rand said, that our rights stem from the fact that all individuals are equal, and all mm-hmm. should have the same rights. And because we're human beings, we have rights for that reason, not because we're people of color or we're white people or because we're gay or straight or whatever sort of identity label you would put on it. It's not and our project of expanding rights, you know, if a certain subset, if a certain group, you know, has less access to rights because of what the government's done, we want those rights expanded, but we don't want rights expanded because that group deserves rights, but because all people should have equal rights. And that's, I think, a uniquely now perhaps unpopular or confined only to libertarians.
And the right has its own variant of tribalism, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we see
absolutely.
This, for instance, in Religious Freedom Protection Acts, that there are certain types of belief that should exempt people from potential punishments, but only if they say, This belief stems from my belief in God. And I think conservatives do that just as much as people on the left are doing it. And, you know, I wonder if there's a little bit of a kind of, you know, it's just like with partisan transfer. When your team is ascendant, you use the power of the state or the power of your university's disciplinary committee to enforce your beliefs. And then you unfortunately create precedent for the other side to use those same powers when they are ascendant.
Well, you know, speaking of that, do you think that there's anything some of us among the libertarian cognoscenti are somewhat...
Please never use that phrase again.
Yeah, no, I already... I withdraw that phrase. But a number of libertarians are, you know, guardedly optimistic. That's not even quite the right word. But to say, okay, well, you know, liberals recognize that... you know, under 8 years, for various reasons, Barack Obama arrogated more and more power to the executive branch in a way that literally leaves, or not literally, figuratively leaves a loaded gun in the Oval Office, as I think the subtitle.
Hey,
the
we
Gene
don't know
Healy's
what's in the Oval Office. There could be a literal one there too.
Yeah, no, that's I'd be kind of disappointed if the Churchill bust isn't actually an explosive device. But you know, but do you think liberals will grab onto the idea? Because, you know, a basic libertarian idea is that, you know, a government that is powerful enough to do give you everything is powerful enough to take things away from you. And is there a moment where we can reset the debate to say, look, I mean, everybody in America believes in limited government. Nobody actually, even Elizabeth Warren, you know, Bernie Sanders, Michael Moore, they don't want the government to be able to dictate, to have a say in every decision that you make. Republicans don't believe that for the most part, you know, or not at all. Is there a way that we can use this transfer of power to seriously reset the debate, not just until the Democrats take power again or the Republicans lose power again, to, you know, I mean, really change the framework that we all kind of pledge allegiance to or take seriously?
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately. I mean, I would like that to be true. And I think that there is a potential that if Trump does something as president that's truly, truly outside of anything that we can consider ordinary presidential behavior, maybe that could serve as a reset. But, you know, we had Obama, you know, droning civilians on the regular, and everyone was like, well, all right, that seems okay. And it was because of the red team, blue team alliances. And I struggle to see a way in which that
can I sense. Before Robbie talks, can I ask, and this goes back to, you know, in a different way, you talked about, okay, well, this, you know, it's tribalism. When do new tribes begin? Or does it make sense for all of us who want to, you know, enlarge the size of the libertarian tribe or come up with a different tribe? Like, how do new tribes form? Because tribes aren't stable. You know, they rise and fall. And, you know, what are the policies, or not policies, but, you know, what are the dynamics that give rise to finally where we just say, oh, fuck it, I'm done with it. You know, I'm moving. You know, because fewer and fewer people actually identify as conservative and as liberal than, you know, did 30, 40 years ago. Same with party affiliations. There's a lot of people who, you know, a lot of tribe members who are kind of getting shit out. And, you know, how do we, where do we open up, you know, the roller rink that we can all get together and hang out on weekends?
I do think that this is where you get your kind of expanding circle of humanity theory going. You know, the idea that the world is more peaceful, more interactive, less violent than it's ever been, not least because it's easier than it's ever been for us to see our neighbors as humans, to see them as self rather than other. And there's, I think, something to be said for just chronic exposure to people who are different than ourselves and panic about, you know, epistemic closure and Facebook bubbles aside, I do think that's happening. I think that's an almost inevitable force. And that's why I think it's so disheartening when the Women's March says, oh, not that kind of women. Right. You're the other. You're not self. Because we're used to the trend being a kind of expanding circle of humanity. I think that's the solution here. It's not when do the tribes realign? It's when do the tribes just expand to the point where they are, you know, global. And right now, Trump's tribe, you know, his tribe is white working class people to some extent. But I think as we've parsed the demographics of the election, what we've seen is that people believe that Trump's tribe is just America, which is maybe actually better. I mean, nationalism makes a person nervous, but better America than just my city, just my state, just my region. And that's, I think, where I would disagree with conservatives. Conservatives would say, no, that kind of tribalism is good and healthy. It's identity politics tribalism that's bad. Right. I would say they're both bad.
And in terms of forming new political coalitions, it is still true that the up and coming, coalition of young people, of millennials is, I mean, millennials are, it is true that they're socially progressive and, you know, pro-immigrant and tolerant, and, but also, you know, not altogether unfriendly toward a lightly, at least, libertarian or neoliberal sort of economic view, right? They actually, aside from the kind of, you know, social justice warrior young person who gets a lot of media attention, mm-hmm. and for good reason in some cases where they control so much power on college campuses, but that you know, most millennials are, I think, kind of broadly favorable to free markets. They think, they might say they like socialism, but what they actually mean by that is that they like a welfare system to protect poor people, but they like free trade. Yeah, you know, they don't mean they want the government to own the means of production. I don't think they trust the government to run the economy. They like choice. They like the choices that result from a broadly free market system. And that's a good thing, and that's a broadly optimistic trend, I think, for the future.
But they do trust government to punish powerful corporations that misbehave. And that's the place where I think it comes into conflict with what we believe and comes into a weird congruence with what Trump believes, that we need the power of the state to check the power of other large players.
Well, you know,
that's not quite the same as a free market coalition.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that, you know, millennials, and I guess we have one, if not two, on the call, and it's not
two.
Me. Yeah, so
not two. Millennial.
All right, yeah, Catherine,
Nick,
are you?
You're always trying to shove me in the millennial box.
I'm just,
man.
You know, yeah, but you know,
you got to label me, man. I'm just a human being.
You know what? No, you know what? We're just an aggregation of demographic terms that mean nothing. But what I was going to say is that it's clear that the millennials don't fit neatly into, you know, the boxes that have been built by the Silent Generation and by baby boomers and Gen X people, for sure. And I think that's pretty interesting. What I was going to ask is, you know, in terms of punishing corporations, people like Elizabeth Warren, people like Bernie Sanders, people like Hillary Clinton have gone hammer and tong after the sharing economy, primarily because it is a threat to, or it disrupts the definition of an employee. And these are people who have been working in government for a long time, and the whole designation of somebody as an employee rather than an independent contractor carries a huge amount of regulatory burden and weight and expectations and all of that. And this is one of the things where I don't, you know, do younger people who use Uber, do they use it despite their contempt for the profit taking that Uber will eventually, one assumes when it starts making a profit? You know, do they care about that kind of stuff? And is it more that it's just these shadowy, like, phantasms of, oh, well, I hate Goldman Sachs and the mortgage industry and international bankers and things that are so large that they don't really have much meaning in day-to-day life?
I think one thing that confounds people about Uber is that it's both huge and small. Mm-hmm. That precisely because it's a bunch of contractors working for, a large corporate entity, sort of parsing, am I helping out a small businessman who is managing to make a living using just his car and his wits, or am I dumping money into Travis Kalanick's bank account in part of the soulless capitalist system? And I think that because Uber kind of walks that line, it also avoids some of the visceral response on the part of younger people. For people like Hillary Clinton, though, it's, I think you put your finger on it when you said it's their tax designation, right? Mm-hmm. It's which It's which box they fit in and how much money can be extracted from them by the federal government. The fact that the IRS is constantly trying to push people onto employee roles and out of contractor status shows to me that being a contractor is frequently better, right? You know, that it's better for your own bottom line, that it's better for your autonomy. And I don't think that younger people have the same wariness of being contractors themselves that older people do. So I'm incredibly hopeful about the sort of economic changes that could be caused by a generation of people who are cool with being on contract for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bad things result from the inertia of employment, particularly employment as conjoined with health insurance and as conjoined with having a gigantic mortgage on a house you can't afford.
Speaking of choice and millennials, this is the start of National School Choice Week, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast. Let's talk a little bit about that. Robbie, you have in the newest issue of Reason a story that you co-authored about the presence of police on K through 12 schools. What's the story about and why is it important?
Yeah, so in kind of explaining to people why having more options in education is better than confining people to attend the public school in the zip code to which they were born, I think a powerful case for expanding school choice, for expanding options, is the fact that over the last few decades, the traditional public school system has become more and more militarized. There are more and more police in schools. If you go back to the 1970s, there were virtually zero police officers in schools. Now, I think something like 40% of public high schools have a designated police officer who works in the school. It's called a school resource officer. This is really troubling for students' rights, because when there's a disciplinary issue in the school, things that would have typically in the past been handled by the school principal or by the teacher or by the parents, the kids get into a fight, you give someone detention, someone's clapping erasers for a week, you're going to assign them a paper, you're going to do some sort of traditional disciplinary action to improve the student's behavior. That's the point of school, in some sense, to socialize young people. Instead of handling it like that, if you have a police officer in the school, a lot of these disputes get raised to the level of legal action because the school says, well, we'll just let our police officer handle it. And I've seen case after case now of things that clearly should not have involved the police. And to give this sort of most powerful example recently, all these examples of kids using their phones to send inappropriate pictures to each other, as you know, sexually interested teenagers would do. And it's, you know, I'm not saying it's good. Parents should discipline them. They should take their phones away. You should handle that. You should teach them to respect each other's privacy and bodies. Instead, the police are dealing with it. And you see kids, teenagers, getting charged with trafficking in child pornography and being charged with sexual exploitation, being shipped off to jail, getting charged with felonies, because in some cases you can charge actually a 17-year-old who's in high school. You can charge them as an adult for having pictures of their own body, which is considered having pictures of a child, even though you're charging them as an adult. I've seen that happen multiple times. So we want to liberate part of the case for expanded school choice is liberating families and young people from a situation where they are forced to attend this increasingly kind of dystopian educational environment where they're going to have run-ins with law enforcement from a very early on age that make them very less likely to go to college and become productive members of society if you have a stupid arrest.
Now, under a really robust school choice program, though, you would probably see supermax schools where parents could choose to send their kids to incredibly militarized and fortified schools, right?
Well, yeah, and if you have, you know, some kids are very troubled for whatever reason, and you might want to put them in that environment. You know, if you want to choose a more stricter environment, you can do that. Yeah. We're not, you know, the argument for school choice, though, is not saying this is the right way to educate your kid, or even that there is one right way to educate all children. It's saying that the people best equipped to make those decisions are parents and the kids themselves, and let's have a range of options and find out what works best in general and what works best for specific kids.
Catherine, did you ever have to – were you scared off a life of crime by clapping erasers for extended period of time.
You know, I actually think that's, we've probably now figured out the root of all of society's ills, is there are no longer erasers to clap. I mean, there are all these smart boards and whiteboards, and it's really, that's the trouble. No, I mean, as someone who is sort of a comically well-behaved type A, goody-two-shoes type kid at a very kind of diverse public, who went to large diverse public schools for her whole education, you know, I'm just old enough to have missed this era for the most part. We didn't have metal detectors. We didn't have school resource officers, which is the euphemism for these cops in schools. But the people who came just after me did. And I think the big difference is, you know, you're teaching kids that cops are the enemy, which is A, probably not a terrible lesson for some kids to learn, but B, hardly the point. This is not where we should be at this point. And the fact that it all does spring out of this kind of panic about crime in schools, about mass shootings, about gang activity, you know, so much of which is driven by dysfunction outside the schools, dysfunction caused by adults acting foolishly. It's sort of doubly sad that kids are stuck just because, as Robbie says, of their area code, of their zip code, without any choice but to have a cop breathing down their neck every morning when they walk into the school building.
And this is also teaching like fundamentally anti-libertarian or anti-free society messages to kids, right? If there's a cop in the school, because we know that you're supposed to, you know, that you have rights, that you're supposed to be read your rights, you know, you don't need to talk to a cop without a lawyer present, all those things that denizens of a free society have. Well, kids don't know that. If they're talking to the cop in their school, they think it's just like the guidance counselor or something. We don't want kids to lie to the guidance counselor or say, I need to consult my lawyer first, right? We want them to be fully honest with authority figures inside the school, because they shouldn't be suffering like legal consequences. But a lot of these kids don't know, because they're young, that they have rights, and they're learning the wrong message about the way people, members of a free society, interact with government and law enforcement. Mm.
Catherine, what excites you the most about school choice at Reason? You've written a lot about education reform, and particularly how technology changes, and not just technology, but different arrangements change things. School choice is on the grow. There's something like 3 million students at least in charter schools, and that's up from zero about 20 years ago because they didn't exist. What do you think is the best case for school choice, and what are the sorts of outcomes that you find most heartening?
So I am the mother of a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and one thing that's been interesting for me is, after covering this from an abstract perspective, to sit down and actually fill out, you know, the city of Washington, D.C.'s charter lottery form, which you do. One thing that I think people who cover this abstractly don't realize is that while charters are a huge boon, and, you know, the availability of charters has certainly led to lots of kind of creative class, highly educated, wealthy people staying inside the borders of Washington, D.C., rather than moving to the suburbs, just as one consequence. It also, for me, really drove home how far we still have to go. When you enter a lottery for a spot in pre-kindergarten or in kindergarten here in D.C. for a charter, the odds are incredibly long for the high-quality charters, and you can't plan your life around it, right? I mean, you can't say, you know, I'm going to move to this neighborhood and my kids will attend this school, because each child has to lottery in. Sometimes you have to lottery in multiple times. There's no predictability. You know, there's a reason that we don't typically allocate scarce goods with lotteries, and it's because it's not the best way to most efficiently allocate them. It's still better. It's so much better than no choice at all. But I find myself sort of becoming more interested in the two further out points on the spectrum, one of which is, you know, can technology kind of cut the Gordian knot of this entire policy question. You know, can we simply let kids, you know, can we hand kids a tablet and join, have them join a soccer league and call it a day? Mm-hmm. You know, what does homeschooling look like in a world where both parents work? That sort of how can we solve those problems of unschooling or breaking the school formula on one end? And then on the other end, the question of, you know, do we now need to be looking more at vouchers? Do we now need to be looking more at a more aggressive privatization where by opening up the market for education, we create affordable options, more options, a larger variety of options that don't still have this artificial restriction of the lottery? As is the case in D.C.
Which seems to be happening. I mean, both Nevada passed an educational save, essentially a universal education savings account. Arizona's looking to things. Texas is looking into that. That would do that, where the state would give a pool of money that parents could use to kind of like Pell Grants, but for K through 12. Catherine, can I follow up? Because, you know, I have two sons myself. One is graduated from college. The other is a sophomore in high school. Do you find it as your kids enter school, as opposed to daycare or pre-kindergarten or even kindergarten, it's immensely anxiety-inducing when you I may have been an outlier here, but it was odd because my kids, you know, were raised in a two-income household, so their mother and father were working all the time, and we put them in daycare pretty early on. And, like, you know, that was odd, but it didn't bother me. But then the idea that I was kind of surrendering my child to a public school system that I had no – I mean, there were literally no other options in the town that we were in at the time. It was just immensely anxiety-inducing because it seems like such an important thing and – not to have much say over. And even if you do have say over it, it's kind of like you really never know until you hear the click of the barrel of the gun at the temple of your head when they're in high school, waking up one morning, that you made the right choice anyway.
Yeah, maybe I'm just not there yet for the consequences part. Certainly nothing involving the clicking of barrels. But,
watch any movie you can about the Menendez brothers.
Thank you for that calming advice. No, I mean, I think it is for a lot of people. And this actually gets back to something I was saying earlier about how there's a bunch of forces that kind of stick people in a physical location. Some of them are unavoidable, but for many people, the reason that they're staying in place has to do, again, with, you know, a job where they exist as an employee rather than on a contract basis, where their health insurance comes from, they're sort of set up for property ownership and taxes. Mm-hmm. And then if you have the single school, I understand that people feel sort of trapped and confined. I do think, and this is my sort of hippy dippy side, that, like, you're only as trapped as you choose to be, man. Yeah. Like, there are options that didn't exist. But I find that it's less about anxiety and more about, to pull the trigger on any of those less orthodox options is a huge time sink. There is no incentive for the Starbucks of non-public education right now. And there really should be. All I want is, like, homeschool Starbucks. And there are so many barriers to that that are all about the public school monopoly and teachers unions and the kind of political dynamics around that. They can't emerge. For regulatory reasons. It's not just that no one's tried.
So, and by the way, Starbucks for kids, I mean, you're essentially, you want to bring back factory work for pre-adolescents.
Right,
yeah, now they have so much, they can do so much more. Yeah. They can do real close work. Robbie,
I mean, you know, you're joking a little bit, but actually,
I agree.
Particularly older kids being able to do productive work instead of dioramas of the Scarlet Letter.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's a crazy thing to say.
As somebody who, I guess I went to high school from like 78 to 81, I graduated in 81, and Pink Floyd's The Wall was out. And it was every kid, it was like you realize, well, this is what school is. It's just, you know, it's a factory that produces only irregular underwear. You know, it's like you go through on a conveyor belt and get churned out and, like, you never pass inspection. It's a horrible thing. And I think in a lot of ways, we're so post-industrial in almost all aspects of our lives. And it is amazing to me that the last bastion of kind of an industrial mindset where there is one way to do things, one way to produce things, and that is to produce like goods from like inputs is education, which even most private schools are kind of like that, you know, where they're not really advancing the ways to educate people. Mostly,
you can pay $40,000 a year for the same 50-minute periods of the same five subjects.
And I mean, you were talking about unschooling, like, you know, it just seems like the radical experiments, and I guess a lot of them didn't work, and some of them influenced pedagogy, but you just don't hear much about, you know, except in some homeschooling situations, you just don't hear really interesting, you know, experiments in doing education differently after, you know, at least 150 years in the United States of, you know, a very fixed model. Robbie, you went to Catholic school for elementary school and high school. Did, you know, was that your choice? Was it your parents' choice? Are you generally happy? You know, this is the other problem with school choice is that, you know, as a student or even as a parent, you don't really, you really can't run a lot of experiments. You're either all in or you're all out. But what was your experience like?
Yeah, my experience was boringly satisfactory. I attended a Catholic K through 8 and then all male Catholic 9 through 12. And, you know, they were better. That's the schools I wanted to attend. They were better options than the public schools in my neighborhoods. Public schools in my neighborhoods weren't terrible, but these were just better options for me. And we, you know, we didn't have, and you know, my high school, yeah, we didn't have metal detectors, or you could come and go as you pleased. My friends who had, you know, graduated like the year before would still come into the high school and like have lunch with me sometimes. It was like you could come and go as you pleased. I don't know what lessons that holds for. I mean, it was a great option for me. I'm sure it wouldn't work for a lot of people. Not all of my friends like
going
there.
For instance, women, I guess, couldn't go there. Yeah. So you went to a segregated, you went to a gender segregated.
Yes.
Why was this in Saudi Arabia or was this in Michigan?
It was in Detroit, Michigan, man. Yeah, Detroit, Michigan. Yeah. It was a fine way. You know, there was a mixing of the genders at, we had dances, you know, we had a play, I think.
Priests who dress up as nuns, that's not a mixing of the genders.
We were run by the Christian Brothers, actually.
Oh, very good.
We were not taught by priests or nuns, but by brothers.
Brothers, yeah, no.
Yep.
Well, they have an excellent reputation for education, for sure. That's an A-list thing. I must have been the only person, actually the other people from my now closed-down high school. I went to Catholic high school and grammar school in Middletown, New Jersey, in a place called St. Mary's. And our high school was Mater Dei, which is Latin for Mother of God. And it shut down a couple years ago. Brian Williams of NBC News was the most famous alum. And I kind of hilariously got a dunning letter from the school, which was in financial straits, talking up Brian Williams, you know, that the school had produced such great people like him, asking for money to keep it afloat right as the Brian Williams scandal stories broke. So that made me feel even better about it. And the Catholic schools that I went to were actually crummier than the public schools in my hometown, which had many more resources. And if you were in the upper end of the class spectrum, scholastic academic spectrum, you could have taken, you know, three times as many languages. My high school's highest math class was pre-calc. You could take up to calculus two at the public school. So it was kind of interesting. And yet I think my parents certainly valued having a choice. And, you know, I can't really attest to how much it helped or deformed me. But there's no – it just seems to me the more choices that you have in education, as in coffee, as in grocery stores, as in neighbors, you know, the better. And I'm interested to see when that kind of consumer – demand for options that actually fulfill what you want or your desires fully comes to education. I'm not sure how far away we are from that, but it seems to be moving in that direction, which I think is a good thing.
One thing I'll say is in my narrow demographic, in sort of among parents who live in the city here in Washington who have kids my kids' age, there's not yet a demand for choice. It's a bewilderment at the lack of choice. Mm-hmm. Like, you sort of, there are a bunch of choices for preschools. It's essentially a private market. Right. You know, you sign your kids up and that it behaves more or less like the way that a lot of things in life behave. And even for people who are generally sort of planners, people who are mm-hmm. people who are on top of these type of things, the dawning awareness of how incredibly circumscribed their choices are for the education of their children, which many of these people would say is one of their top priorities in life,
it
would be hilarious to watch if it weren't so sad. I mean, mm-hmm. In my neighborhood school, there are 14 slots in the pre-K class. You lottery in. But 9 of them are already occupied this year by siblings. Right. So there are essentially 5 slots available through this technically universal pre-K entitlement. And the extent to which people take the government at its word when the DC says there's a universal pre-K entitlement and then have their minds blown when they realize what that means is, yeah, but not really. We're going to give you a lesser product in a location you didn't want it, and you're going to have to jump through a lot of hoops to get it. Mm-hmm. People are pissed. And they're confused, but they haven't. I have the feeling that, like, there's not quite critical mass yet of, okay, now we have to fix it. And when that mass gets up, when there's a little flare up of that, then the barriers to entry are so intense to opening a new educational establishment that it dies down.
Yeah, we'll be talking with Jay Green, an education policy analyst at University of Arkansas, and he talks a lot about how he believes that the school choice movement, and particularly charters, but all other forms, have reached what he called an escape velocity, partly because increasingly in states that have most charter schools originally and for a lot of self-evident reasons serve mostly lower income students and minority students. And as their success becomes clear and also upper income parents become more and more disillusioned with the lack of choice. They're pushing for that. And that once that happens, those are the people with the political clout that will actually change things. And Lisa Snell, who will also be talking with the director of Education Research at Reason Foundation, has pointed out that a lot of this stuff can be done very quickly because if you start directing the money to the individual student and it goes where they go, it follows them. You don't actually have to change very much. A lot of the bureaucracy in education will fall away, but there's a pretty easy or clear path to creating many, many more options for individual parents. And that'll probably be the motivating factor that turns this from kind of an outlying experience to the baseline pretty quickly.
The scary thing is that always pushing back against that is this incredibly powerful, incredibly well-financed interest group, the public teachers unions that fight absolutely every incremental positive change on all these fronts, and they are dedicated toward doing it, and they are, super entrenched and powerful within the Democratic Party.
Well, and it's not just them, it's administrators, it's, the police will have a say in this too, because right. if they have a cop in every school, which, and maybe we'll end on this, just a quick discussion of Betsy DeVos, who is Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education. And to bring it back to Trump, one of the things that's interesting is Trump very early on said he's in favor of all forms of school choice. Federal funds only account for about 10% of K-12 education. They have an outsized influence because a lot of federal rules attach to that 10% of money and different programs. But this is a place where overwhelmingly lower income minorities and minorities in general, particularly African Americans and Latinos, support school choice because they would see overnight, many more options that upper income people of whatever race or whatever ethnicity can buy a good school by moving into a particular area or town or something like that. And I'm kind of hopeful in this sense that Trump again is confounding, our existing tribes because so he's a piece of crap who, is vulgar towards women and seems semi-insane and dismissive of minorities and yet – or is the savior of the white working class. And yet he's the first president in a big time – in a big way to absolutely be in solidarity on the school choice issue with lower income ethnic minorities. So maybe.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, on one hand, he picks, you know, Jeff Sessions to be attorney general, someone with, I think, a fraught civil rights record.
Yeah.
And, that in that sense, low income minority people would be justly concerned about him. On the other hand, he's picking Betsy DeVos, who is someone with this really stellar record of promoting school choice reforms that, you know, liberate particularly low income families and families of color. To pick different and perhaps better educational options, and you have the left absolutely hammering her, going all in to try to destroy her for doing this, because I think they're so beholden to teachers unions. They've gone after her. You know, I'm from Michigan, so I've been familiar with her work for a while, and there you have everyone from like the New York Times claiming that the record of education reform that she helped foster in the city of Detroit is negative, when if you look at like the actual data. Okay, sure. Not every charter school succeeds. We know that. We fully admit that. But on net, this was, you know, introducing these reforms, increased the outcomes for students. You know, not every student, not in every school, but it was no worse on the whole. It was better in a lot of cases. And the New York Times will see that study and turn around and say, oh, this actually shows that school choice is bad because, you know, in these couple of cases, it didn't work out. I saw there was an education professor wrote for the New York Times that this poll of economists shows that economists are actually skeptical of school choice. And that's weird because, you know, economists are generally for free market. So if they're skeptical of school choice, that's this huge indictment. But then if you look at that actual survey, you saw that, you know, it was a very narrow question, and you know, the largest group of economists said, well, I'm not quite sure if it'll be great for absolutely every student. And then the next largest group said, yeah, it's great. And then the smallest group said, no, I think it's bad. And she used that to say, well, see, economists are skeptical of school choice. And it was the survey data from like the year before. The more recent data was even more positive for school choice. So I'm disheartened by these very kind of attacks on school choice and on Betsy DeVos particularly, but I expect she'll weather them.
I also think the attacks on DeVos are this is now the real test of the critique of charters, which public school advocates have been trying for many, many years, which is to accuse them of profit seeking.
Right.
And I think it's a weird tack, right? For one thing, most charters are nonprofits. Even the charters that are managed by for-profit charter management companies, they're typically, we're talking about very small dollars here compared with, for instance, I don't know, the broader money spent on public schools, right. The money that public teachers unions rake in. It's simply not a massive industry, and the places where profits are being made, they are being made in the sort of most textbook way of these are relatively small companies that make money and turn that money back into growing their businesses. And, you know, I don't mean to say that every dollar made by a for-profit charter management organization has been spent responsibly, but the real focus of the attack on DeVos has been she doesn't care about children. She cares about establishing an industry and helping that industry make profits. And, you know, I'm actually kind of interested to see where that critique lands, because I do think people are skeptical of big corporations. I don't think, and we were talking about this earlier, that millennials in particular are skeptical of profits per se. The idea of making money is not as abhorrent to them as it is to, for instance, boomers. And the idea that DeVos
speaking as a boomer, I will say that boomers are only upset at the prospect of other people making money.
Right. Of course. Yeah. And, you know, as DeVos is, you know, the notion that working hard to establish a industry that encourages charter management and diversity of choice, like, that shouldn't be an indictment. Working hard to establish an industry that provides a much needed service and goods that are right now not being offered in a market that's totally screwed up, that's good work.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I would love to see people stick up for her on that token. I don't think they're going to. We still ask our education officials to do this kind of weird, you know, mama librarian teacher vibe, which DeVos seems to be doing her best to offer, despite clearly being a pretty hard-headed gal. So we'll see how that plays. But I think it's interesting that that attack, which worked somewhat in D.C., the attack on Michelle Rhee, as being interested in somehow channeling money for the purposes of making profit to these charter management organizations, you know, that somehow could be always necessarily in conflict with providing the best education to kids. You know, that's a huge question, and I'll be interested to see how it plays out.
Well, we will leave this Reason podcast there. I want to thank Catherine Manga Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. You can subscribe to it. It comes out every month, and it's wonderful. You get full electronic access as well for $15 a year. Go to Reason.com, subscribe. Catherine, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, sir.
And Robbie Suave, our the dean of traffic, the sultan of traffic, the czar of traffic at Reason.com, writes widely about a lot of stuff, including education reform and higher education antics. Robbie, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am Nick Gillespie, and this has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode. While you're there, please rate and review us. Tell us what we're doing right and what we could be doing better. Thanks for listening.